Thank you very much indeed for having me here today. It's a great honor, it's a great pleasure to see many of you old friends and new faces. I just want to say that just here in this room, I gave a talk ages ago now, on Anaxagoras, which was the beginning of the project that then developed into a book. So I'm really pleased to come back a few years later with the development of that project that is now drawing on that book and my new book on Plato to give you this talk on relations. So the title here, it's ambitious, because I want to make a general point even if I cannot go into the details. And the general point is this. We are all, generally speaking, children or grandchildren of Russell. So we, contemporary metaphysicians, think that there are monadic properties and polyadic properties, and polyadic properties are relational or serve as relations connecting things in the world. So I don't want to say all metaphysicians, because there's always an exception, but many contemporary metaphysicians endorse what I call here relation realism, which is a view expressed here in the words of Jonathan Low, that a further relational entity over and above the relata is invoked or needed to explain how the truth of a relational sentence. So that's relational realism, positing that there are relations over and above the relata to explain or to make true relational statements. But the ancients did not think that way. So imagine here is a big divide between the way contemporary metaphysicians think of this issue and ancient metaphysicians thought of this issue. And I want to stay on this side. And in the company of these three, whom you probably recognize, well, Aristotle probably everybody recognizes, this is Plato, and this is Anaxagoras, much less studied pre-Socratic, but that I argue had great influence on Plato. So these three ancient thinkers just belong, I think, to the same camp, or we would say nowadays the same research program. They want to build a world without relations. How do they do that? Well, it would be an interesting paper to give, just to give a comparative account of what the three of them think. But for reasons of time, I'm going to focus here just on Plato. Plato's ontology is pretty lean, we could say. His toolkit includes individuals, forms, and partaking. And I'm making the claim here against many in this second-hand literature that Plato does not admit relations in his system. So for Plato, forms are not relational properties, they don't relate. Partaking, which is instantiates in objects the property that the form stands for, is not a relation. And I'm going to argue for this thesis that Plato, following Anaxagoras, builds a relationless system based on what I call here institutional overlap, which I claim is more primitive than relations. So this is the thesis that I'm going to develop in the paper. So I articulated this a bit more this way. I want to say that Plato develops, and the word develops here matters, develops partaking as the metaphysical tool in the theory of forms, and with partaking, understood as overlap, Plato is going to explain the qualification of objects, relations, what we call relations among objects, and also necessity governing certain ways objects are qualified. So, partaking is going to explain certain necessary patterns of participation in forms as well. So these three things are done by Plato, one thing, only partaking. It's quite elegant, I think, compact sort of ontology, and I'm going to show you how I think Plato does that. So Plato, I think, draws for this idea of partaking on the work of Anaxagoras. There's a lot to be said about Anaxagoras, here I'll just be very brief, but I'm happy to come back to it in discussion. The main point that matters to us is that Anaxagoras introduces in his system the relation of, introducing in his system partaking by parts as the mechanism by which objects are qualified. So something is hot by having a part of the property hot in its constitution, part of share. So partaking by part is constitutional overlap. Something is hot when it has a part of hot in its constitution. Now, of course, there are important differences between Anaxagoras and Plato. Anaxagoras' properties are natural properties in the physical world. Plato elevates his properties to the realm of forms. But for present purposes, this doesn't matter to us, but again, we can come back in discussion. The main thing is that Anaxagoras is the one who introduces the idea that things are qualified when they're parts of the property as part of their constitution. So that's constitutional overlap, partaken by constitutional overlap. Now, I argue that Plato does endorse this view of partaking that comes from Anaxagoras, but also innovates from Anaxagoras' thinking. Innovates because Plato posits that objects partake in forms individually, so a certain thing is hot by partaking in the hot, but also partake in forms plurally. And that's what I'm going to develop as a new approach to Plato's physics. We will see also forms partaking forms, but I'll leave it in parentheses for now. So we'll concentrate now on plural partaking in forms. So I said that Plato develops partaking throughout his metaphysics, and I want to give you the starting point. The starting point is pretty soon, pretty early, in the Hippias Major, so before the theory of forms, where Plato contrasts two cases. So let's say that these chairs, let's say, are green, because each of them is green. But contrast that case with the case of Socrates and Hippias are two, although neither of the two is two. Socrates is one, Hippias is one, Plato and Socrates are two. So how is it the case that Plato and Socrates, Hippias and Socrates are two? Who is the subject of that being two? How is this possible that Socrates and Hippias are two, but each of the two is one and can't be other than one? Important, Socrates and Hippias cannot serve as a single subject, because if they were a single subject, it would be one and not two. So this is a threshold. It's a really interesting puzzle. We get the clue in the Hippias. I'm going to be quite quick on the textual evidence for reasons of time, but we get only a clue in the Hippias Major. It is sentence that the being, there is some being that adheres to both Hippias and Socrates. But what's the ontology behind this kind of predications that are quite puzzling? The ontology is given by Plato in the Phaedo. So in the Phaedo, Plato introduces joint qualification by partaking in form. So he comes back to the example that he had given in the Hippias Major, and he now says, well, Hippias and Socrates are two because they partake in the form of duality. But neither of the two partakes in the form of duality. They together partake in the form of duality. They can be two only if they jointly partake in that form, so they share part of that form. Here is joint partaking. So remember, Plato following Anaxagoras thinks that partaking is literally having a part of the property as part of the object's constitution. So that's for one object and one property. So how do we apply this understanding of partaking to the case of Hippias and Socrates? This way, Socrates and Hippias being two is understood as Socrates and Hippias jointly share a part of the form of duality. Socrates does not possess a part of the form of duality. Hippias does not possess a part of the form of duality individually. But they together jointly possess a part of the form of duality. And that's what makes them jointly qualified as two. So neither of the two is two. The two together are two. Why? Because jointly partake in the form of duality. And that's new, that's different from the standard way that, you know, the standard type of participation we are all familiar with in Plato's metaphysics. But it's here in the Phaedo, and my argument is going to be that Plato is going to build this up a lot in his system in ways that will allow him to develop an entirely relationless ontology. So being two, just to recap, this is joint qualification. It's a joint qualification that is explained by joint partaking. Partaking is overlap. So joint qualification is sharing a part, two objects sharing a part in their constitution. Now, Plato extends this reasoning to the case of putative relations. I say putative because Plato does not admit relations in his system. So he treats the case of being equal like the case of being two. So for Plato, here is my interpretation, equal things are equal, not to one another, but together with one another. Like being two, Hippias and Socrates are two together with one another. It's the same metaphysical treatment that Plato gives of this case of equality. And that's an important point, because Plato generalizes that to all symmetric relations. So I'm asking you here to think of this sort of shift in how we understand relations. We think that we contemporary metaphysicians, generally speaking, think that relations are like a bridge that connects to objects and organic properties that can introduce to serve as that bridge. But this thinking, no. Instead of thinking of relations, think of things in the world that are jointly qualified. And by being jointly qualified, it means they jointly, together, partake of one form. So they are a part of that form as part of the constitution. So the objects overlap constitutionally with the form, and in a way overlap with each other, because they are a part in common, that is the part of the form. And this is interesting, this is very powerful, I want to say. Just think in your mind, I can't develop more examples just now, but just think in your mind how thinking of all we posit as relations in terms of joint qualifications is a game changer, changes the picture of things. I submit that this is a very significant metaphysical move that Plato makes, and I want to make the case that it is as significant as the very famous one of the many principles. So as much as the one of the many principles tells us that similarity between the many is explained through the oneness of the condition, the one for many principle, as I call it, explains joint qualification of the many through joint partaking. So these principles are very powerful because they offer an ontological solution to a logical, semantic type of problem. And they are equally, I think, foundational in Plato's system. So far, so good. Maybe thinking, well, we cracked the problem, we have a solution, good for Plato, let's assess how the solution is. But I emphasize from the start that Plato develops his metaphysics of participation. So although in the Phaedo he gets this type of solution that relations are joint, what we think of in terms of relations are just ways of things to be jointly qualified, he also discovers already in the Phaedo difficulties for his own account, or challenges we could say. So Plato discovers in the Phaedo what we consider asymmetric relations, very problematic in contemporary metaphysics, and also necessary sort of patterns of participation among things. So by symmetric relations, I mean something like this. This is an example from Plato. Socrates is larger than Simmias because of the respective sizes. And as an example of the type of sets that Plato is thinking about, fire always comes with heat. Fire is always hot. So the question that Plato puts to himself, and what we need to think about, is how the characters given so far can apply to these kind of cases, asymmetric relations and necessary patterns of participation. Can Plato handle these difficulties? I argue that Plato has a way of handling these difficulties a bit later on in the Sophists, and the way he tries to handle these difficulties or challenges for his theory is by introducing an extra tier of forms, the so-called great kinds. So the great kinds are forms like of being, sameness, difference. Plato gives a few examples, but there is no reason to restrict the number of great forms in his system to the examples that he gives. So we have the great kinds, which is an extra tier of forms, and there Plato also introduces a new type of partaking. So it's kind of trying to work on the relation, trying to work on partaking to make it fit the metaphysical sort of challenges that it encounters. So the type of partaking that we get in the Sophists is what I call here permeation, just to use a metaphorical term, because Plato himself uses lots of strange words like mingling. So the great kinds permeate other forms, or we could put it differently, forms, ordinary forms, partake in an extra layer of forms, the great kinds. But that kind of partaking between form and forms is described by Plato as permeating, or being permeated, which is a different type of partaking from the partaking of an object in any form. So what does permeating do? What is kind of partaking do for Plato? What does it do for Plato? The thought here is that permeation of forms in great kinds is used by Plato to do two kind of things, just exactly the challenges that he had found in the Phaedo. So by permeating other forms, the great kinds qualify with necessary properties the forms are. So a form of beauty is necessarily self-same. And also, they set what I call necessary patterns of partaking of individuals in form of this kind. So look at the examples, because they're different and interestingly different. So two things that are triangular, each of them is triangular, are necessarily jointly qualifying as the same. And two things of different size are necessarily qualifying parallel as large or small. So you see here, I've introduced one more expression. So jointly qualified, we have seen it before. Qualified in parallel is a different idea here. How does it work? Here is an illustration. So take Plato and Socrates. They are of different heights. So Plato partakes in largeness and Socrates partakes in smallness in such a way that Plato partakes of the large in parallel with Socrates, and Socrates partakes in smallness in parallel with Plato. And it is necessarily the case then that Socrates and that Plato is larger than Plato and Socrates, because the form of opposite permeates the large and the small. So in other words, these two forms have an overlap with this great kind up here. And this great kind, by overlapping with two other forms, determines the necessary patterns of participation in such a way that two individuals of different size necessarily participate of the large and small, so that the one is larger than the other. And that's how we get an account of asymmetry, what we call asymmetric relations. We also get an account of necessity, because the permeation of this form with these two other forms makes it the case that something that is partaking here is going to be larger than something that partakes in here necessarily. So, where are we are now in the thinking? The interpretation that I'm offering is that Plato has an account of, generally speaking, plural qualifications, such that if X is a triangle and Y is a triangle, X and Y necessarily are necessarily jointly the same. If X is size 3 and Y is size 4, then X and Y are necessarily, if X is size 3 and Y is size 3, then X and Y are necessarily jointly the same. And then if X is size 3 and Y is size 4, then X and Y necessarily are qualified in parallel as smaller and larger. So you see the sort of economy, if not elegance, of this system. So all the types of qualifications there are in the world that are, for us, classified as symmetric or asymmetric relations, for Plato are dealt with as cases of symmetric or asymmetric qualifications. Symmetric qualifications are dealt with as joint partaking in one and the same form by constitutional overlap, and asymmetric asymmetric qualifications are dealt with by Plato in terms of being qualified in parallel with something else. So Plato can do all of this that we want a good metaphysician to do without introducing relations, but only joint and parallel partaking. So this idea of partaking by constitutional overlap, with these developments that Plato reaches in the course of his thinking, do all the work that we posit relations to do. Sounds good so far, if you're sort of buying into the story, but Plato is a metaphysician in progress. Like most of us, think of counterexamples to his own thoughts. And the great kinds, although seem to offer some sort of solution to the case of asymmetric relations by allowing this permeation that explains qualification in terms of necessary patterns, the great kinds also bring about regressive infinities of plural partakers. So I sort of spell it out here just in terms of sameness, but it can be recast in terms of many other great kinds. So take any pair of partakers in the same. Any two pairs of plural partakers of the great kind the same are the same. Thus, two spheres jointly partake of the same, and two triangles jointly partake of the same. Thereby, these two pairs of joint partakers are each the same. which suffices for the two pairs to jointly partake in the same and become together the same, and so forth, and infinitum. So you see how regressive this becomes. So what happens in this system is that although these regresses are not vicious, they are so complex and so endless that the system loses intelligibility. So what was supposed to be an advantage of introducing the great kinds, namely to sort of expand the theory in such a way that could account for asymmetric relations, now becomes a problem for the theory. The theory is basically unintelligible. What does Plato do? Where are we now? Well, we are in a maze, I'll say. So we get these sort of first order forms that overlap with sort of second order forms, and now everything overlaps with everything. It's a very complex system. So objects overlap with forms, forms overlap with other forms, overlap and go on ad infinitum. It feels like a real maze. We're lost. And Plato, I think, sort of registers this difficulty, but in the positive sense of the emergence of a new type of metaphysical model. So I put here, you know, very sparse quotations from the text, but what Plato is basically telling us in the Sophists that from all these overlaps of forms with other forms and objects with forms, a sort of metaphysical edifice, as I call it, of structural qualifications governed by necessity emerges already in the Sophists. And the Sophist is for Plato a transition point, I want to claim. So Plato realizes, I think, in the Sophist that although the great kinds were supposed to deliver a solution by extending the theory to cover asymmetric qualifications, the theory becomes simply too complex. So a shift is needed, you know, a fresh start is needed. What is the fresh start? Well, Plato basically embraces the thought that he needs to posit not so much, not individual forms that overlap with each other, because then the overlaps become so many and so complex that the system loses intelligibility, but rather, Plato thinks he should embrace the thought that there is a metaphysical edifice, what he calls the paradigma, which comprises all the forms and embodies all the overlaps. So just imagine here, I'm going now to switch to our parlance. At this point in the Timaeus, Plato is not thinking anymore that he has to explain the world by interconnecting forms, by overlap. Plato is thinking, no, there is only one sort of uber structure that embodies all connectivity in the world, and that is the paradigma that will overlap with the objects in the world. Big shift from many forms to one only that embodies them all in a structured way. So what happens to partaking now that we have this shift in the thinking? Partaking takes a different outlook now. So from the Timaeus onwards, as well, if there is an onwards, Plato now is thinking that individual objects in the world partake of the paradigma. So they don't partake of individual forms one by one and of other forms by overlap. Plato thinks individual objects in the world partake of the paradigma, which comprises all forms. But now, is it the case that when a chair partakes of green, partakes of all forms? That's the obvious possible puzzle you may feel there is here. No, because Plato adapts his theory to this idea that now, instead of a realm of forms, there is one paradigma, by introducing the demiurge, this mythical creature which is supposed to craft the world by copying the paradigma onto the world. But the demiurge, that now acts as an efficient cause in the system, is intelligent, so selects which aspects of the paradigma is going to copy. And that's why whenever there is a green chair, it's not all the forms are copied there. The demiurge selects which aspect of the paradigma to copy. So the demiurge copies structure onto the world selectively for each kind of object. So the shift here is that it's not the demiurge does not build the world by having objects partaking of forms and form partaking of other forms, which comes to be a sort of endless edifice of overlapping, but rather criticize there is only one form, the paradigma, that embodies all these interpermeations and overlaps that we were talking about before. And that's by partaking in that, objects in the world acquire properties and structure. Now, the relation of parthenia at this point is conceived very differently by Plato. We have resemblance, so the demiurge copies, as I said. So now the objects in the world resemble the paradigma. They don't have a part of it as before. And it would be a long story to discuss how these two conceptions of partaking develop in Plato and how Plato sort of investigates them both throughout his metaphysical career, but always leaning on Anaxagoras' partaking by parts until the Timaeus. But this is another part of the story which I'm happy to come back in discussion. So for now, I just want to leave you with a few conclusions to leave as much time for discussion as possible. So, an interesting fact. Plato, like Anaxagoras and Aristotle, who I didn't go into their ontologies, does not refine relations in material forms. So there are no relational forms, and partaking is not a relation in Plato's system. Plato thinks of we think of as relations as joint qualifications. These joint qualifications are ways of objects in the world to plurally partake in form. So plurally partaking means that two or more objects have a part of the relevant form together. They share that part. They constitutionally overlap with property, they constitutionally overlap with each other in this system. Now, I say plural partaking because Plato tries to cover all types of relations with this idea of partaking. So for symmetric relations, joint qualification works fine. For asymmetric relations, Plato feels the need of introducing the great kinds, which allow the type of partaking we're seeing with the large and small. And I call that parallel partaking to differentiate it from joint partaking. But joint partaking and parallel partaking are two types of partaking by parts that Plato uses to account for how things in the world are qualified in ways that we consider relational. Plato's account is not circular because he understands plural partaking in terms of constitutional overlap. Overlap is really the key to the system, and what's interesting is that overlap is something that Plato borrows from Anaxagoras. And I want to argue or put to your consideration that given how difficult we find to account metaphysically for relations, this idea of Plato that we can account for relational facts in the world in terms of overlap looks like an interesting economical and possibly viable way of thinking of relations for us too. And that's me. Thank you.